This is Only a Game. I'm Karen Given. On January 13th, Clemson and LSU will play for the College Football National Championship. Fans of Clemson football are hoping their Tigers will bring home the trophy for the third time in 4 years. But this is a Clemson story of a different sort. Here's Only a Game's Gary Wallach.
In August of 2018, when Aaron Ritz was 11 years old, he was diagnosed with polycystic kidney disease.
I was nervous because I didn't know what it was. Whenever the doctors were telling us what it was, I just asked, am I going to die?
The doctors told him he wasn't, but they needed to run some tests. Aaron was awaiting the results in the South Carolina hospital room when in walked a stranger.
I heard the door open, and he walks through the door with his big old hat, and I didn't know who he was.
Aaron is a big fan of Clemson football. As he soon learned, the stranger was Clemson superfan Dean the Hat Cox. He's called that because of his oversized cowboy hat in blazing Clemson orange. He's become such a fixture of the Clemson community that he's the go-to guy when head football coach Dabo Sweeney can't make hospital visits. So back in August of 2018, the Hat paid Aaron Ritz a visit.
We talked for a few minutes, then he gave me a Hunter Renfrow jersey and a Hunter Renfrow picture that was signed.
Hunter Renfrow was Aaron's favorite player. He was in his last season as a Clemson wide receiver when Aaron was diagnosed. But the Hat had even more gifts up his orange sleeves.
I took him a hard hat that was signed, a Tiger $2 bill.
The Hat is one of the most enthusiastic distributors of the Clemson $2 bill. We featured him in a story about it last August. The traditional Clemson $2 bill has orange tiger paws stamped on it. The one the Hat gave to the kid had something else.
It said, get well soon, the Hat, go Tigers. And he said, this was my favorite get well card.
After more tests, doctors told Aaron that his kidneys would soon stop functioning. He'd require dialysis, and then he'd need a transplant. He was put on a waiting list and released. A few days later, the Hat invited Aaron and his parents over.
So I've got a man cave. Dabo Sweeney has called it West End Zone 2 because there's so much stuff. Taj Boyd, one of our old quarterbacks, his mom calls me the Clemson hoarder. That's a compliment.
It was very orange. He has this mannequin head where he puts his hat. He has a Clemson pool table.
A little over a month later, Dean the Hat Cox pulled some strings and planned something really special.
The kid had no idea.
We were just getting out of a doctor's appointment, and we're all getting in my dad's truck, and I said, what are we doing? And they said, we're going down to Clemson to eat dinner with Dean or something like that, and we ended up pulling up to the practice facility.
So they were having practice. Dabo came over, talked to him.
6'6" Clemson star quarterback Trevor Lawrence visited with Aaron, too.
He walked over, and I got to talk to his kneecaps, and then he said, good luck.
But Aaron still hadn't met his favorite player. After most of the team had returned to the locker room, Hunter Renfrow was still doing reps on the field. When he was done, he came over to Aaron waiting on the sidelines.
Now, Hunter Renfrow, he never gives his gloves away.
It's a superstition. Renfrow likes to wear his wide receiver's gloves over and over again.
But he gives Aaron those pair of gloves.
Renfrow told Aaron they were the ones he wore during a big Clemson win over Texas A&M. When Renfrow left for the locker room, Aaron turned to the Hat.
He was like, Hat, here's what I'm going to do. We got this pair of gloves from Hunter Renfrow. He said, it's got his DNA. So I'm going to give you one glove for your man cave, and I'm going to keep a glove. So we'll never have a pair unless we're together. I was like, dude, you're killing me. I mean, 11-year-old kid giving me something.
What made you want to give such a great treasure, one of the gloves, to Dean Cox?
Because he did so much for me, and he's given me so much Clemson stuff, and I just wanted to give something back to him.
I mean, and then he told me, a lot of kids will never get to do what we did tonight. So, you know, even if I don't get a kidney, I've had a lot more fun than a lot of kids will ever get their whole life.
This season, the Hat has driven his Clemson Tigers golf cart around tailgating parties, collecting donations in 5-gallon buckets labeled Aaron's Army. Aaron's mom, Brandy, had to quit working while Aaron was getting treatment.
So all of that came in very handy to help, you know, pay our car payments, house payments, whatever we had.
Brandy and her husband, Jeremy, estimate the community has raised about $30,000 in support of their son. On November 2, 2019, the same day Clemson improved to 9-0, Aaron got his new kidney after a 14-month wait. He's back home after a month in the hospital. He would have been home earlier, but the kidney didn't work well at first. The Clemson football community has been there for him throughout. Jeremy Ritz says that's made a big difference.
There was this huge group of people that were willing to spend time with Aaron, talk with Aaron. We were getting contacts from England, Scotland, the West Coast, and everybody came together and rallied around him, but the Tiger family was just absolutely overwhelming.
Aaron's 13 now. He's in seventh grade, but he's good enough at golf to be a member of the high school team. In the meantime...
Well, we're going to sit back, hope and pray, and watch this kidney and watch Aaron start to grow and get back to normal. And just pray that everything works out the way we hope it does.
I think you're forgetting something really important here. What about the football? You going to be watching the football?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that's a no-brainer.
Yeah.
I finish my chat with the Ritz family and ask Aaron what he'll be thinking about as he watches his new friends defend their national title on January 13th.
Whenever they're on the field, I'll think of that and say, hey, I know him. I've met him before. He's a really nice guy.
Dean the Hat Cox will be in New Orleans to attend the championship game. Aaron will stay home in South Carolina. He'll watch the game on TV. But wherever they are, and regardless of who wins and who loses, they'll always be a pair.
That's Only a Game's Gary Wallach. It's time for three stories you should know. David Stern, who served as NBA commissioner from 1984 to 2014, died on Wednesday at the age of 77. And that's where we'll start this week. I'm joined by Lindsay Gibbs, who recently launched Power Plays, a newsletter about sexism in sports, and by Professor Kenneth Shropshire, CEO of Arizona State University's Global Sport Institute. Welcome back to both of you.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you.
Lindsay, you're up.
You know, there's so much about David Stern's legacy that we can touch on. People talk a lot about the impact of getting the NBA playoffs off of tape delay, which they were when he first started, or the Dream Team and how he handled Magic Johnson's HIV diagnosis. But I really, on brand for me, I just can't talk about David Stern without talking about the WNBA. The WNBA would not have launched without David Stern's leadership. He liked to deflect a lot of the credit to Val Ackerman, who was the first president of the WNBA, and she certainly deserves a lot of the credit. But let's be real, if he hadn't wanted this to happen, if he hadn't pushed this to succeed, the league wouldn't still be here 24 years later. And I just don't think you can talk about him without talking about what a pioneer he was for women's sports.
Ken, how have you been remembering Stern this week?
I agree with that WNBA analysis wholeheartedly. And I think that's also a place where you can understand kind of his abrasive harshness in the way he did it. I mean, all rival leagues be damned, this is what we're doing.
Right. And,
but his path was the path to keep a women's league intact for the long haul. The other gender issue that, you know, as Lindsay was talking, I was just thinking about it, was Rick Welts. And Rick Welts, who was a longtime NBA exec, worked in the league office and then team president in a couple of places. Basically, when Welts went to tell Stern, well, I'm going to come out, Stern was like, well, okay, so what? And he wanted the world to react in that kind of way. But it was that kind of support from this guy who, as I said, could be very abrasive. You can think of some of the issues that he pushed forward on, the dress code, the racist undertone of it. But in the end, I mean, to see these guys walk into a game and see the fashion show, the evolution was the right outcome. So I think that and the globalization, this is something that we have not seen before from a commissioner. And people say, you know, who's going to be on the Mount Rushmore of commissioners? I mean, he, in my mind, is number one.
Absolutely. He's already there. It's amazing how when you look back on what he's done, so much of it, and I would exclude his decision not to oust Donald Sterling sooner from that, but so much of it turns out to be really right. But Lindsay, like you, I've really been struck by the people who are pointing out how committed Stern was to the WNBA. Michelle Vopel of ESPN made the point this week that Stern didn't support the WNBA out of a desire for power or legacy or wealth. He already had all those things. He supported the WNBA because it was the right thing to do. And even though many of us are still wishing that the NBA would do more to support the Women's League, it is nice to be reminded of the fact that the NBA has done more to support women's professional sports than any other U.S. league.
Absolutely. I mean, I think you can he's not perfect, and he's certainly it's interesting because while he viewed it as the right thing to do, he still didn't really view it as a charity. He still really wanted to make it money, and he was still a hard line negotiator when it came to contracts. I talked to the very first WNBA Players Association executive director, Pam Wheeler, and I was bringing up in 2003 when during negotiations he had threatened to shut down the league, and she told me, David always threatened to shut down the league. So he really had a hard bargain, and I think that there are certainly some controversial decisions he made. But I still, when people leave out that part of his legacy, to me it says a lot about the people who were telling the story. And I have been frustrated by a lot of NBA writers not even giving this a passing mention.
All right, Ken, you're up.
Well, there's another kind of legacy moment that we can look at, and that's in this NFL hiring season and what we've just gone through with Black Monday. And this is where NFL coaches are en masse fired and the new hirings take place. So this is something that's been looked at closely since the Rooney Rules enacted back in 2003. So the Global Sports Institute has taken a 10-year look back to see where we are. And let me just give you some of the highlights. One important piece, and this is kind of designed as a motivator, there are four teams that have not hired a head coach, offensive coordinator, or defensive coordinator of color over this past 10-year period. So that's the Cowboys, the Rams, the Patriots, and the Saints. The Rooney Rule back in 2003, there were only two head coaches of color. So there is a positive evolution. I mean, last season, not the one that just ended, the previous season, there were eight. But if you think about most head coaches come from the offensive coordinator ranks, 77% of those over the past 10 years have been white. And the average age of Black coaches has been 51, whereas for white coaches, 48. You need more experience if you're a Black coach. And part of what we see in the study that kind of looks at the coaching shape of the river is how are the qualifications different for these different groups, white coaches versus coaches of color?
Lindsay?
Yeah, I think it's just staggering that this is still such a problem. I think the Rooney Rule did have an immediate effect, but a lot of that has plateaued. It just seems like every year we have this exact same conversation. But I just, you know, want to see real progress, and it's ultimately got to come from building up this pipeline.
Ken, I have to say, I pored over every slide of this report, and we're going to have a link on our website for listeners who want to check it out. And every time I scroll down just a little bit more, I'd find myself hoping for like just a tiny little glimmer of good news, you know, just one sign that the deck was not completely stacked against candidates of color. And I just found myself getting more and more depressed as I read. And the thing that most got me to my core is the stat that says coaches of color are less likely to be given second chances. Because we think of this as like some sort of coaching carousel, where a coach gets fired from one team and hired by another. But disproportionately, coaches of color don't get those second, third, and fourth, and fifth opportunities. Would a Rooney-like rule at all levels help? In other words, would it help to ask organizations to seek out and interview candidates of color for every position, not just the position at the top? Or is it not a problem of a pipeline? Is it just a problem of lasting stereotypes and racism?
Yes to all those. Is that the right answer?
Sure.
So it's very difficult to figure out what the answer is other than a vigilance that continues to look at this. And if we give people the benefit of the doubt, maybe they don't really realize they are looking at the two groups, white coaches versus coaches of color, differently in terms of what qualifications must exist. I mean, Major League Baseball, we saw this forever, that you almost had to be a Hall of Famer before you could manage in baseball.
Right.
And we'll be looking at that place next because there's not much success going on there either. So football is not alone, but these problems are long-term and, as was suggested, systemic. And to keep the information out there, I think, is one of the best things we can do.
Well, sticking with the theme of football head coaches, ESPN's Adam Rittenberg published a piece this week looking behind the scenes of coaching shifts during the College Bowl season. And the piece opens with the story of Ryan Silverfield, who served as head coach for Memphis in their loss to Penn State in last weekend's Cotton Bowl. It was the first time Silverfield held a head coaching position since 2004, when he was 23 years old, and he coached Memorial Day High School in Savannah, Georgia. So why does this kind of thing happen? Well, this time it happened because former head coach Mike Norvell had already left to coach at Florida State. He took the team's defensive coordinator with him. So in one swoop, Memphis lost its offensive and defensive play callers. And as it turns out, this kind of thing happens all the time because college football head coaches tend to swap jobs sometime between rivalry weekend and the Heisman Trophy ceremony. ESPN presented this problem as something that's tough on coaches. And I'm sure it is, but I know I'm going to sound like a broken record here, but I can't stop thinking about how differently we treat coaches who leave their schools early versus players who decline to play in bowl games because getting hurt would cost them tens of millions of dollars over the course of their NFL careers. And at least the backlash against players who leave early is dying down. But still, if you ever needed another example as to why there should have never been a backlash in the first place, this is it.
Yeah, not only the players playing bowl games, but the transfer rules where you have to sit out a year in order to be able to play, whereas coaches just get to pick up and leave anytime the money calls them. And the whole bowl system is... I got to say, like, I grew up a huge sports fan, but I did not grow up in a college football world from North Carolina. So it was college basketball. So I still don't understand the bowl system. And this is just, for me, another example. While they're kind of meaningless games, like, if the coaches can leave before the game is even played, I just don't understand what we're all doing.
All right. I know people at home are probably saying they're not meaningless.
I know. I'm going to get a lot of hate mail, but I had to say it.
All right, Ken, you do come from a college football background, right?
Well, just past leather helmet period, yes. But and we had this experience. We had our coach was fired the day before the big game. We played the game, and then a search went on to find the new coach. And the new coach came in. The recruits got to meet the new coach. Sort of, the calendar was much better then.
Yeah.
And I think the pressures that are in place are both the race to get the next great coach and taking people from staffs that are in place before these bowl games. And then the recruiting calendar. If you could schedule better when you allow coaches to sign and readjust when student athletes are signed, and Lindsay's absolutely right, allow them to go where they want to go if their coach leaves.
Yeah, I mean, the NCAA has plenty of rules that affect when players can sign. It wouldn't hurt to have one or two that affects coaches. My guests for this week's edition of Three Stories You Should Know have been Lindsay Gibbs, co-host of the Burn It All Down podcast, and she recently launched the newsletter Power Plays, and Professor Kenneth Shropshire, CEO of the Global Sport Institute at Arizona State University. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to Only a Game from NPR.
Hey, it's Ben.
And Amory, and we're the hosts of Endless Thread,
the show featuring stories found on the website Reddit.
But you don't have to be a Redditor to enjoy the kinds of stories we tell, like a couple experimenting with non-monogamy.
Or a board game that may have predicted the attacks on Pearl Harbor.
Subscribe to Endless Thread on Apple Podcasts.
Or wherever you listen.
I'm Karen Given. Rosalie Fish is an enrolled member of the Cowlitz Tribe of Southwest Washington. She started running when she was a student at a public middle school in South Seattle. She liked staying in shape, hanging out with her friends, improving her times. Then, in 2015, she transferred to the Muckleshoot Tribal School on a reservation south of Seattle. That's when her running started to take on a new meaning. Reporter Eilish O'Neill has her story.
When Rosalie Fish signed up for the Muckleshoot Tribal School High School track team,
they told me, track is a little spotty in attendance. And I said, okay. That doesn't affect me.
So Rosalie went to the first practice.
And everybody else was field events, mainly throwers, shot putters.
Rosalie realized she was going to have to do her workouts on her own.
Being a female native runner is kind of isolating. It was a normal feeling to be alone.
When Muckleshoot went to meets, Rosalie would be her school's only runner. She says more than once, she wasn't invited to meets, even though she'd run the qualifying times. Once, she called to ask why.
They asked me if I even had a uniform. I guess I was just really naive to the type of racism and prejudice that comes in through sports because I'm white passing. So I never really experienced that firsthand like I did with having Muckleshoot Tribal School on my uniform.
In the winter, between cross country and track, Rosalie played for the girls' basketball team and cheered for the boys. After one of her games, she walked into the school's bathroom and found graffiti on the wall. It said,
Indian savages, Indian drunks, live off the government, all over our bathroom walls.
The Muckleshoot Tribal School is a K-12 school, and there were lots of little kids at the game that night, hanging out with their friends or watching their older siblings play.
I think I felt more let down than anything, almost like disappointment. This is still something that I have to fight. I can't believe that this is the way that people still perceive us. And maybe sad in the fact that this is something that my younger siblings are going to have to challenge. That these are something that all of the middle school and elementary schoolers at tribal school are going to have to face.
Rosalie has two younger brothers and two younger sisters, and she feels protective of them, along with all the other kids at the Muckleshoot Tribal School.
It was traumatizing for some kids to know that there's people who come to the games at the school who think a certain way about them and they don't even know us. And for me, that's why running and being successful became that much more important to me, to show that these kids that they're wrong about us. Then I started doing harder workouts. I started making sure that I was running at least 6 times a week, if not 7.
Rosalie switched up her diet and even stopped hanging out with some friends who encouraged her to skip practices. She says it wasn't always easy. She'd internalized some of the discrimination she'd experienced.
At times it really can feel like this is what you're set up to do. There's no exceeding that. And my coach would tell me that I'm going to hit this time. And then I would say, I don't know. I don't think you're right. I'm going to set my own bar that's lower and safer. And I'd run the race, and I would hit their expectations, so I was literally proving myself wrong. And that was when I started to get a little bit more confident in myself.
But Rosalie was still her school's only runner.
Waking up on Saturday mornings and going to the school and putting on my watch, and it's like 87 or 90 degrees out, and I'm thinking, man, I don't want to do this. But behind that comes the sense of, I have people that are counting on me. If I go to my next meet and I just biff it, they're not going to look at me as, some kid who wasn't ready. They're going to look at, the native girl who didn't belong there. And that was really what kept me going, is knowing that I'm not just representing myself at these meets. I'm representing my tribe, and I'm representing Indigenous people.
Rosalie's junior year of high school, she was Washington State champion in the 2 mile. So Rosalie felt like she was doing well, running well, being a good role model. But while she felt strong on the track and in her school, there was another area in which she felt completely powerless. To tell you about that, I have to tell you about something that happened when Rosalie was just 3 years old. In August 2004, Rosalie's aunt Alice Looney disappeared. Her body was found more than a year later, wedged under a tree on an island in a creek. The FBI lists the cause of death as inconclusive. And Rosalie's aunt wasn't the only member of her community to disappear or die under suspicious circumstances.
I grew up, you know, seeing lots of missing poster signs of Native girls and Native women, or just stories of Native women being murdered. And then it wasn't until people started talking about it kind of online and in like Indian Country Today and these kinds of platforms where I would see missing and murdered Indigenous women epidemic.
Well, some people are calling it an epidemic. They want to know why Native American women go missing or are murdered at rates higher than the rest of the population.
It is being discussed with the hashtag MMIW. That is short for Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women.
A haunting national disgrace with no solution in sight.
Cases of missing and murdered women often go unsolved.
In the U.S., murder is the third leading cause of death among Native women. And in Canada, Native women are four times as likely to be murdered as non-Native women. Over the past couple of years, activists have started drawing attention to the problem.
And that's when it really hit me that this isn't just Muckleshoot. This isn't just my reservation. This is happening across reservations in the U.S. and then in Canada, even. It really felt hopeless.
Then, in April 2019, Rosalie learned about Jordan Marie Daniel.
There we go.
Jordan ran the Boston Marathon with a red handprint over her mouth to symbolize the women who had been silenced by violence. And with MMIW, Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women, painted down her leg. She dedicated each mile of her race to a different missing woman, 26 women in all.
And it made me realize that I actually can do something.
Rosalie had qualified for the state track meet in four events, the 400, the 800, the mile, and the 2 mile. And she thought she had a good chance of winning some of those and placing in others.
And then I thought, well, what can I do? I'm going to have this platform at state championships. So what am I going to do?
First, she wrote to Jordan Marie Daniel on Instagram.
Because the idea wasn't mine, so I asked her permission.
And I said, of course.
That's Jordan Marie Daniel.
I felt very inspired that she was inspired by me.
And I was super starstruck when she responded. I was freaking out.
From the very first text, I called her Matankala, which means little sister. And in her language, she calls me big sister. And I told her to call me or text me anytime. It didn't matter, day or night. If she needs someone to talk about this with, I could help her. If she needed someone to vent to after her races, that I was there for her.
She was really supportive, and she gave me some tips and helped me sort my emotions and how I was going to go about running for Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women at my state meet.
Rosalie decided to paint a red handprint over her mouth and run each of her races for a different missing or murdered woman from her reservation. On the first day, Rosalie ran the mile for her Aunt Alice Looney, the one who had disappeared when she was 3 years old. She won the race.
But it was my first time not running for myself. And everybody kept asking me, you know, how does it feel to be a state champion? How does it feel to, you know, be up there on the podium with this gold medal? And I kind of just wanted to tell them to leave me alone. That whole event, state championships, felt so insignificant to the issue I was representing. I didn't feel like celebrating. I couldn't celebrate. And I had ran a slower time than I anticipated because everything felt so heavy. And so I went and I messaged Jordan that night and I asked her, what's going on? Like, is this normal?
Jordan understood. She'd felt that way herself. After running Boston for 26 women, she'd run a 17-mile trail race for 17 different women and a half marathon for another group of 13 women.
I didn't expect the emotional and mental toll that it was going to have. And it got so bad and to the point where I had to, like, stop racing. I had to stop and try and take care of myself and understand how I'm feeling and the anxiety that it was causing and, you know, the depression that came with it. It's not just the fact that it's an epidemic. It's the details of some of the research that I do and finding the names that I want to run for and who I want to run for and dedicate it to. And it's those details of what happened to them that are in my head. And, you know, it's creating a very dark environment for me.
So when Rosalie called, Jordan told her,
just feel these feelings. Feel it out. Don't try and ignore them. Don't try and justify them. Just know that you honored missing and murdered Indigenous women the best way you could.
She reminded me that I was strong and that I could do it. It definitely changed my entire perspective on why I was running. When I went into the first race, I was still in this idea that I want to get 3 or 4 gold medals. And after I spoke to Jordan, it was, how can I run this race in a way that makes sure that I still have energy for the race a few hours away so that I can represent each of these women with integrity and with strength?
During the next 2 races,
I absolutely still felt heavy when I ran, but I felt more prepared.
Rosalie took first in both the 800 and the 2 mile. Then it was time to get ready for her last race, the 400. The 400 was already a little outside her comfort zone. She'd raced it as a workout during a meet early in the season, and she unexpectedly ran a state qualifying time. Before the race, Rosalie's coach came to talk to her.
And he said, I know your legs are tired, but you don't care. You don't care that your legs are tired. You don't care that you haven't had a break yet. He said, because you're running for more than this medal. He said, you're running for Misty and Jackie and Renee and Alice, but you're also running for your little sister Solstice and your older sister Cedar, and you're running for my daughters Niala and Khalil, and you're running for all of the little girls at tribal school, and you're running for Indigenous women everywhere. And he said, that matters most to you, not how tired you are.
Rosalie ran a personal best. She came in 2nd place. She says she was satisfied with that. Today, Rosalie Fish is studying and running at Iowa Central Community College. She still plans to run for Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women, and she's still close to Jordan Marie Daniel. As for Jordan, she says she plans to keep at it until she feels like she doesn't have to anymore.
That's reporter Eilish O'Neill in Seattle. We first saw Rosalie's story in the Seattle Times. Growing up, WNBA legend Tamika Catchings used to get teased about her hearing aids. So one day, on her way home from 3rd grade,
I just remember stopping, and I took one hearing aid out, then I took the other hearing aid out, turned to the field, and just threw them as far as I could.
That's coming up. And remember, you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at OnlyAGameNPR.
Do eat this, don't eat that. If you feel like it's time to finally end your war with food, this is the podcast for you. Food, we need to talk. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Karen Given. Next week on Only a Game, the story of one man's journey to the priesthood, which includes an ESPN headline at the height of Lynn's sanity. But now Charlie Pierce is here with the week's news. Hi, Charlie.
Hi, Karen.
Don Larson died this week at the age of 90. Larson is the only person to pitch a perfect World Series game. He did that with the Yankees in 1956. How will you remember him?
You know, this was a famous thing that happened. I was 3 years old when this happened. I don't remember it happening, but it was something everybody talked about.
You know, possibly my favorite thing about Larson's story is that he never won more than 11 games in a season, but still he holds a major league record that can never be broken. It can only be matched. It kind of makes us all feel like we can have that moment of greatness, right?
Yeah, I mean, I hesitate out of respect to call it a fluke, but that's what it seems like.
Broadcaster Kevin Harlan is having quite a big NFL season. First came the black cat call, who can forget that? And then on Sunday, Harlan was calling the Chiefs-Chargers game when suddenly this happened.
Touchdown, Miami! The Dolphins have just scored! I'm getting confused. What game are you calling?
I'm calling both games.
Epic, don't you think?
I thought that was great. Kevin Harlan is really bad. He's had a breakthrough season. If anybody in the NFL has had a breakthrough season, it's Kevin Harlan.
So, as you know, the Patriots lost that game to the lowly Dolphins, and they lost their first round bye for the playoffs. Are you finally ready to admit that the Brady era in New England might be over?
Maybe the run of championships is. I'm less sure about whether Brady will finish his career here. I still think he probably will.
I suppose we knew it would happen eventually. Ole Miss has hired former Maryland head football coach DJ Durkin as an assistant. In a statement, the school said they were assured of Durkin's strong character and work ethic and, quote, positive impact on the communities and institutions where he was previously employed. Funny, that's not how I remember Durkin's time at Maryland. You?
And that's not the way Maryland remembers it either. He's being hired to work under Lane Kiffin, who Ole Miss hired as its head coach. And it's starting to look to me like they're just begging for the NCAA to set up shop in Oxford again.
We should remind listeners that 19-year-old lineman Jordan McNair died of heat stroke while Durkin was head coach at Maryland. An ESPN report called the culture there toxic.
There's a lot of things DJ Durkin can do, but he should never be in any kind of supervisory position over young people ever again.
Yeah. You called it, Charlie. Carmelo Anthony seems to be fitting right in with the Portland Trailblazers, and he proved it on Wednesday night against his old team, the New York Knicks. 26 points and an ovation from the crowd at Madison Square Garden. Not bad, eh?
Yeah, he's looking to be a New York legend. That's what I've never been really a Carmelo basher.
Yeah.
I mean, I realize that of the people he came into the league with, which are basically LeBron James and Dwayne Wade, he's always going to be the third wheel. He's never going to be recognized as the player they were because he wasn't the player they were. But he's a very good basketball player. If he wants to be, you know, warmly received in New York, that's fine.
If you believe the headlines, Zion Williamson's return to the NBA is imminent. Of course, these headlines came after Zion had participated in just one full practice after knee surgery, and Zion is reportedly not traveling with the team this weekend. So maybe we need to remind the headline writers of the definition of the word imminent?
Either that or we need to remind Zion that he's still got a lot of work to do. There's absolutely no reason to believe he'll be back before the All-Star game.
I mean, we can't really blame Pelicans beat writers for getting excited about a possible return. It's not like they have anything else to hope for. I'm going to get letters about that, aren't I?
You are, yeah. But they'll all be written in French, so you won't have to worry about it.
Taco Fall is sixth in initial All-Star voting for the Eastern Conference front court. The 7'5" center has played just 11 minutes for the Celtics this season and averaged 4.2 points and 2.3 rebounds. Those aren't exactly All-Star numbers, are they?
No, but I mean, this is people wanting to see the guy, and I can't blame them. But judging from what I know from I actually was at the tournament where his college team played last year. If he were somehow to, like, make the roster, he wouldn't take the spot. Mm. He's a very smart, very dignified young man. And I think he'll show up and everybody will flock around him, but I don't think he'd take the spot on the roster.
And finally, Charlie, 3 months after the Cubs fired Joe Maddon, the Wrigleyville restaurant that bears his name has closed. Patrons in that part of Chicago are known for being a touch inebriated. Do you think it took them this long to notice that Maddon wasn't there anymore?
That's a very, very good question, but I suspect that particular locale will stay vacant for about 11 minutes. Having been to Wrigleyville, I know that prime saloon locations don't go vacant for very long.
Charlie Pierce is the guest editor of the Best American Sports Writing 2019, and he joins us each week at this time on Only a Game. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Karen.
Only a Game listeners, are you still looking for a New Year's resolution? Well, I've got an idea for you. Commit to never missing an episode of Only a Game. What's the best way to do that? Subscribe to the Only a Game podcast on Apple, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you find your podcasts. To Tamika Catchings is one of the greatest WNBA players of all time.
Catchings thought about it, still thinking about it. Spin move, the take, oh! And two!
Wow.
She's been a champion and an MVP, and she won a league-record 5 Defensive Player of the Year awards. But success didn't always come easy. Only a Game's Jonathan Chang has the story.
When Tamika Catchings was 3 years old, she was at a playground with her family. That's when her parents found out she had a problem.
My dad was behind me, and he was calling out my name. And finally, after calling out my name a couple of times, he basically saw me. It's like, I wasn't moving. I had no recognition that he was even talking to me.
A few years earlier, Tamika's older brother had been diagnosed with a hearing disability. So her parents knew the signs.
And so right after that day on the playground, my mom and dad took me to get my hearing tested, and we found out that, just like my older brother, I was born with a hearing disability.
Soon, Tamika got her first hearing aids. She describes them as big, clunky, brown boxes. Tamika's dad, Harvey Catchings, played 11 seasons in the NBA. Because of that, Tamika's family moved around a lot. When Harvey's basketball career was over, Tamika was in second grade.
We moved down to Abilene, Texas, and the kid just didn't get it. You know, I talked different. I didn't have the southern slang like they had, but then also, like, I had a lisp, and I had to wear hearing aids, and, you know, I was tall, too, so that didn't help. Just the constant nagging and the constant getting made fun of and, you know, just being different, that was tough. In second grade, you can only imagine when you're just trying to fit in, like, that not what you want to hear, and that's not what you want to get made fun of for.
Then, in third grade,
I remember just waking up one day and I was like, okay, like today's gonna be a good day.
Walking to school with her older siblings, Tamika repeated those words, today is gonna be a good day, over and over again.
But literally, as soon as I walked through the doors, I got made fun of. And I just remember being, you know, trying to be as invisible as I possibly could be, even though I was taller than everybody. And just, you know, trying to blend in, and no matter what I tried to do, I couldn't blend in. On my way home from school, my brother and my sister were in front of me as we were walking past a tall field of grass. I just remember stopping, and I took one hearing aid out, then I took the other hearing aid out, turned to the field and just threw them as far as I could. When my mom finally realized that I didn't have my hearing aid, you know, we went and started trying to look for him. Of course, we couldn't find him. So I remember her sitting me down and just saying, you know, your father and I cannot afford to buy you new hearing aids. You're going to have to learn how to live without them.
So Tamika did just that. She learned to read lips, sat in the front row, and studied her textbooks before class. And afterwards, she always talked to her teachers because
I would have word then blank and word then blank. But every time the teacher would turn to write on the chalkboard, I didn't know what they were saying, and so the teachers would have to fill in the blanks.
Tamika's hard work paid off in the classroom. That year, she also started playing organized basketball. Tamika says that on the court, her hearing impairment didn't feel like an issue. She says most of the communication happens through body language anyway. Still, Tamika says that year was one of the hardest of her life.
Because that was the first time that I realized how different I was than everybody else. I would try to guess what people are saying. Instead of really knowing and understanding, you kind of put yourself in a position where you're already at a loss, especially in rooms where there's a lot of people. It was even harder to stay engaged in conversation. And so I started to shy away from wanting to be in big groups, wanting to be in those situations where I would feel that I couldn't hear or I couldn't understand. And so that's kind of at that point really where I lost my voice. So it was really hard for me to really have my own group of friends. You know, thank God for my brother and my sister. They literally took me under their arms, and just my sister, wherever she went, I went.
But when Tamika was in sixth grade, her parents broke the news that they'd be getting a divorce. Before her junior year in high school, Tamika and her mom moved to Duncanville, Texas, without her siblings and her dad. Tamika had to learn to speak for herself. It helped that by this time, Tamika had become a star on the basketball court. She no longer stood out because she was different. She stood out because she was good. Good enough to get an offer from her dream school, the University of Tennessee. A few weeks into Tamika's freshman season at Tennessee, head coach Pat Summitt asked to meet her in the training room after practice.
You can imagine, just like anybody, any kid that thinks they're about to get in trouble, I was like racking my brain. What did I do wrong? What did I say? Did I, you know, what happened? I've been going to my classes. I think I've got good grades. I can see myself walking to the training room as slowly as possible, trying to figure out in my head what this conversation could be about.
By the time she arrived, Summitt was already there, waiting with the team's athletic trainer.
So I get in there and sit down, and, you know, Pat just starts talking about just how proud she is of me, and, you know, just having me a part of the team is just great, and, you know, worked so hard, and, like, she just went through all this stuff, and I'm like, okay, like, this is good, all right. And then she gets to a point, she was like, you know, when people can't see, what do they need? And I was like, well, they need glasses. You know, they got to be able to see, so get some glasses, get contacts. I wear both, so not ashamed for either one of them. And then, you know, she asked, well, like, when people walk with a limp or, you know, need a little bit of assistance, what do they need? You know, so we went through a series of questions, and the last question that she asked was, when people can't hear, what do they need? And I remember almost hit myself on the head, like, how did I get set up in this conversation? But I was like, yeah, I mean, they need hearing aids. Through the few weeks that I was there, there must have been a couple of times where I didn't fully hear some of the things that she had delivered. And so she kind of started, like, keeping up with that. And so Pat just said, she said, you know what, one day your story will impact thousands, maybe millions of people. I suggest that you get back in the way in your hearing aid. We can get back into speech therapy. That can help you. And, you know, she's like, I want to help you be the best version of yourself.
So before the 1997-98 season began, Tamika started wearing her hearing aids again for the first time since third grade. As a freshman, Tamika averaged 18.2 points and 8 rebounds and helped Tennessee win the national championship. And while she was in the WNBA, she started using her celebrity to talk about her experiences with hearing impairment. Here's Tamika during a TED Talk she gave last year.
Going to the University of Tennessee, Pat gave me a platform to be different, a platform to speak up, a platform to stand out.
If you could go back and talk to the little girl who threw away her hearing aids, what would you say?
I'd say everything's going to be okay. This is what you're going through now. But one day you'll look back and this will just be a part of your story. You will one day impact thousands, maybe millions of people. People ask all the time, if you could change one thing about your life, what would you change? And honestly, I am the person that I am today because of everything that I went through. So I wouldn't change anything.
That story came from Only a Game's Jonathan Chang. Tamika Catchings is currently the Vice President of Basketball Operations for the Indiana Fever. Only a Game is produced by Jonathan Chang, Martin Kessler, and Gary Wallach. Our technical director is Marquise Neal. Our executive producer is me. I'm Karen Given. Only a Game returns next week. Thanks for listening, and Happy New Year.